Good evening, good afternoon, and good morning to all across the globe. You're listening to Thrive, and this is your host, Maureen Moss. It is an honor to welcome my guest tonight, Tom Kenyon, one of the world's most respected sound healers, psychotherapist, and the founder of Acoustic Brain Research, whose focus is centered around the use of sound and music and the effect they have on consciousness and the brain. Tom is highly respected as a mystic and a shaman, and has authored and co-authored with his wife, Judy Zion, many critically acclaimed books, including The Magdalene Manuscript and The Hathor Material. And Tom is also the channel for the ancient civilization, the Hathors, and now the subject of the award-winning documentary, Song of the New Earth. This conversation tonight is really near and dear to my heart, as it was Tom, who was my teacher and mentor for many years, who was the first to introduce me in a very tangible way, not only to the angels and archangels, but to the Hathors, and with whom, during one of his workshops, I had a very profound Kundalini awakening. Tom's website is tomkenyon.com. Welcome, Tom. When I heard from a friend of mine and former student of yours that you were the subject of a documentary titled Song of the New Earth, an experiential documentary about one man's quest to integrate modern science and ancient mysticism through the transformative power of music and sound, I quickly went to see it. Perhaps the first time I saw Song of the New Earth, I began viewing it, but quickly realized I was literally, Tom, being affected in a very alchemical manner and often finding myself in an altered state of consciousness. So, Tom, how did this movie come to be, and how did it turn into an alchemical vortex?
Well, it's funny. I never imagined that a movie would be done about me, never interested in it. Last thing on my mind. And so what occurred was that the director and the producer, Ward, Cyril, and Sophie Mortimer, were in southern France, and they had experienced my work previously. They were in southern France to do a movie possibly about Mary Magdalene, and it became clear that there were so many legends and stories, it was going to be problematic to sort through and navigate how would you create something. And my wife, Judy, said, well, you know, why don't you do a movie about Tom and his work, since you've experienced his work? And there was a brief conversation, and then we parted company. They went, you know, to their place, and we were in ours, and I said, well, I'm really not interested in doing a movie about me. The next morning, they came back, and Sophie said, yeah, I think we should do a movie about Tom and his work. And as I thought about it, I was still very reluctant, because glamour is an antithetical concept to me. I don't think there's anything to be found in glamour or notoriety. But what occurred to me was that the work, by putting a movie out about the work, the power of sound, consciousness, that it could be a tool, a catalytic agent for people who couldn't get to my workshops. Because Judy and I have been around the world almost 6 times, and everywhere we go, we have to turn people away because there's not enough room. And so this was a way to get the work out in the world without me having to be going to larger venues and having to travel more, which I'm not interested in anyways. So it really came out of that central conversation. Then what occurred as we started to map out the movie was we agreed the sound and teaching would be a part of it. And how this evolved, the movie evolved, was actually at workshops. We introduced Ward and Sophie to our network, and over 720 contributors from all over the world came forward and funded this film directly through contributions. And we were told by Ward and Sophie that this is unheard of. This is like a grassroots creation of funding for a film that has never been done like this before. And these people wanted to see a movie about me, my work, which involves teaching comparative alchemy, systems of transformation, and sound. So the money was generated from this network that's international, from many different countries. And as we constructed the movie, we were very clear we wanted to create something that would have elements of beauty. And there would be these periods where people could go in through sound portals, you might call it, little doorways in the movie where the plot kind of stops and there's a pause and the audience sinks into an experience of pure sound, which science clearly shows opens the right hemisphere, and with imagery, beautiful imagery. And that is what is the nexus of what drives the film at an alchemical level. There's the plot, there's the story, there's the cartoons that help drive along the biography of my life. And it's a mix that joins with these alchemical moments. The way those came about are very interesting in that we were having a conversation with Ward at the very beginning of the filming. And as a cinematographer, of course, he was faced with a problem. How do you depict the unseen, which is a challenge? And he wanted to film our people meditating, which is what most filmmakers would want to do. And Judy and I were very clear, no, you do not film our people. Because in the work that I do, I create a space in which it's like a womb where people can go deep inside and explore that territory where the treasures lie, because the treasures are within each individual person. And it's not about what's happening on stage, it's what's happening inside the person. And I did not want, and Judy did not want, that to be intervened on or intruded by having a camera on you. Because if you thought that there might be a camera, if I knew there were a camera in the room trained on me while I was going deep into altered states of consciousness, I would personally not go as deep as I could go.
Mm-hmm.
So we said no. We can't do that. And Judy said, why don't you film nature? Go out and film nature. That event where we had the conversation took place on Orcas Island, where we live. And it was beautiful. The clouds were moving. It was like Taoist land, as it often is here, changes of light and color and fog was. And Judy said, go out and film nature. And that's what you can use as the backdrop. So as we traveled around the world, and Ward and Sophie traveled with us for over 3 years, 3.5 years, he was out filming nature. And Eric Frith, who's the editor, synchronized the imagery that Ward shot with the sound patterns that I picked. And that's how those alchemical moments, as I call them, the sound portals, came into existence. And for me, that's what drives the movie at an alchemical transformational level. And many people around the world who've seen the film say that's what happens for them. The movie is engaging, it's entertaining. And then when these moments occur where there is all dialogue stops, all cognitive thinking stops, and they're presented with imagery and pure sound without language for several minutes, they drop into their inner space, and magic happens.
What you were talking about with the visuals, and they are so stunning, blending seamlessly with the sacred locations. And then, very interestingly, and it made me laugh because I've known you for a long time, and you're very funny, the comic book-like depictions was so beautifully blended, whether it was from the San Juan Islands to where you filmed in the south of France and Tibet. How did that work along with the sacred people and beings that this film was shot with, along with the profound chants and sound healings? It took 3.5 years, did it, to make this film?
It took 3.5 years to accumulate the footage. Yeah.
To accumulate
about
the footage.
That, something like that.
And so in creating all of that, you accumulated the footage, and as you then came by using all of the nature scenes that were created by Judy's suggestion, and then the comic book-like depictions, where did that concept come from?
That was
particularly
at
sacred moments. It was really very interesting.
Yeah, the contrast is very interesting.
Very interesting.
So the cartoon is a way to drive the plot, and people have various reactions. Some people think that there should be more of something else, but most of the comments we've heard from people are that the cartoons add a humor, a contrast, drive the film successfully, and adds an element of unexpectedness and novelty.
And so when you, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm complete on that thought.
When you and I were talking, one of the things that you talked about with this movie as well is that you really wanted to bring forth the awareness of the way that we're living now as a humanity and what's possible for us. And are we missing something in some way that you feel that this movie, the sounds, the chanting, the healings, everything, which we'll get into in a moment, do you feel that this in some way has a way of bridging our consciousness, Tom?
Yeah, and I think it will be different for different people because we all experience whatever is occurring in our life through what Robert Anton Wilson called reality tunnels. And our tunnels, our narrow band of perception comes out of our personal history and our culture and what's happened to in our lives. And you take two people and put them in the movie theater and have them watch the movie. The two people may have both have altered states of consciousness, but when you go into the details of what happened for them, they're often very different, and the conclusions that they might draw are different. That's what's really fascinating. So the potential that comes out of the sound portals and the film as a whole is extruded from each person's individual history. But I believe that what is also occurring is that collectively we are in a period of, you might call it the dark night of the soul of humanity, that the planet is in duress ecologically. We are in a transforming world, and what is transforming into nobody really knows. There's so many changes taking place, and there's so many imbalances. And the film addresses some of these in terms of the Earth, the encounter with the Earth being in southern France, and the theme of the imbalance between the male and the female, masculine and feminine. And that's one of the important themes of the movie, that's in addition to the power of sound to transform consciousness.
When you were considering doing this movie, and since your background obviously has everything to do with transforming consciousness through sound, did you have in your heart and in your mind the feeling that this film could be so much more than just showing what your story was, that it would be in some way a transformative experience to allow everyone to feel their own journey?
Well, that was the point. My experience of the mystery is my experience of the mystery, and everyone else's experience is their experience. And as a facilitator, I hate to talk of myself as a teacher. I'm a facilitator. I tell people I'm the cosmic pizza delivery guy. I just deliver the energies. And each person takes those energies and opens doorways in themselves or not, and it's their choice. But the doorways that they open reveal to them treasures. And what I mean by treasures are new insights, new creativity, new inspiration of how to approach their life differently than how they have before. And it was my hope I know that it was the vision that all four of us had when we started on this journey of the film. It was that it would somehow be a transformational element for the collective. It would serve the elevation of the collective somehow, and it would embrace beauty. Mm-hmm. How that would occur when we began the journey, we didn't know, but that was our intention. And on the other side of it, I believe the movie accomplishes the task. It does introduce something that is important, significant for the individual watching it because of the sound portals and the story, but it also introduces something important for the collective. And there's a recognition, I think, in many audiences that we're out of balance collectively. Mm-hmm. And the movie, while not answering the question, I think very importantly, asks the question.
Mm-hmm.
What are we doing? What is our relationship to Earth? We need to change it. What is our relationship between men and women, the masculine and feminine elements, in terms of our internal, what Carl Jung called the anima animus, the internalized male-female, and how do we approach life differently? Because I think there is a sense among many people who, I don't know who coined the phrase cultural creatives, the people who are living in our culture in a certain way that where they are approaching life differently than the mass. And the culture creatives sense that we need to approach life differently. And I think the film is a catalyst in that pot that people can stir and churn out something of value for themselves and hopefully for the communities they live in.
I felt while experiencing it twice and with different friends at both times that the catalyst for me was the connection that I had to the earth, that it was, there was something that was made stronger as a result of this really amazing film that strengthened my connection to the earth. And I thought and felt, actually, while having the experience of it, how can anybody watch this film and not feel the oneness with the earth, which would then alter our thinking, perhaps, as a mass consciousness as to how we are not only treating each other, which seems to be more of a topic of conversation, than how are we treating the very home upon which we live and each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so in your perception of it, do you feel that the harmonizing perhaps more of consciousness would in some ways be heightened by the connection made deeper to the earth herself?
Yeah, well, that's a very complex question you're asking. And in its essence, I would say, the Reader's Digest version, is that our spiritual traditions that we've inherited, for the most part, with some exceptions, I believe have impoverished us, and they have disempowered us, partly by disconnecting us from Earth, from our connection as living physical beings. There are many spiritual traditions that say there's something wrong in having physicality. There's something wrong with the Earth. We're in Earth because we made a mistake. So there's this subterranean thought form that runs through many spiritual traditions. And there's something intrinsically difficult about being in an Earth experience because we are in duality when we're here. So what the film does is to introduce the question, what are we doing to Earth? We live here, and yet we're damaging ourselves, and the Earth protector, the being that we made contact with in southern France, is at the point in the film where this is really
first. We'll talk about that in a minute, yeah.
Right, but pivotally, for me, the energetic shifted in the film when the Hathors, at the very end of the film, the toning sessions are from different workshops, and that last part of the film was from a Hathor intensive in Seattle, Washington. And the Hathors started toning, and I had no idea, as usual, what was going to happen. But what occurred was an energetic came through very strongly from them in honoring the earth. And then the chant started saying, Om Gaia, praise to Gaia, Gaia as the earth goddess. And then my experience was, in that moment, was that I was surrounded by celestial beings from so many traditions, and traditions we don't even have names for, beings in the celestial realm honoring the goddess Gaia. And it was like, it was so intense and so strong, I almost came to tears. It took all of my emotional mastery to keep myself centered so I wouldn't just break down and sob, because it was such a beautiful moment of these beings in the higher light realms honoring the goddess Gaia, who is in what we would call the lower third dimensional reality, in addition to having other dimensional aspects to herself, obviously, but it was a tremendous honoring of Earth. And for me, energetically, there was a tremendous burst in the film at that very last portion when the voice starts singing Om Gaia.
Yeah.
And this energetic is strongly introduced of honoring the Earth. And Earth is a precious being, and it's an honor, although paradoxically also difficult experience to live here. All of that is all together, and it's introduced energetically in the film. So I think, looking back at it, after people go through these various sound portals and they go through the experience of my life, there it ends with this energetic release of honoring Earth. And I think that many people, and we have heard this from all over the world, many people who are spiritually oriented feel that connection and feel a deeper connection to Earth, just like you articulated.
And I was going to talk about that more at the end, but that we're talking about it in this moment, is that what you just said, it takes you on a journey and deeper within one's own consciousness and altered states of consciousness. And I know for me and all the people that I was viewing this and having the experience of this, there were so many tears. There was such an ancient, I believe, welling up. And I know it certainly came through me both times that I saw it. And I heard that from many people, of just an ancient cry for this, our beloved, precious Earth. And the way you took everyone on the journey, and we'll backtrack in a minute to a couple of other things that happened before that, was beyond anything that I've ever experienced, Tom. And I've experienced quite a bit, and I experienced quite a bit through your work, as for really, really feeling one with the Earth and feeling her great sorrows and feeling her great pain and her great wish for us to love her as much as she loves us.
Yes, right. And, you know, on that topic, just as a sidebar, if the listeners go to the listening section of our website and go to an audio recording called Lament for Whales, this is an experience that Judy and I had in Fiji, where we had gone to actually record and film some reefs, the ecology of reefs, and what happened where the reefs are disappearing in Fiji. And it's very sad. And we were coming back from where we were doing a very small informal ecological documentary for ourselves that we eventually hope to post. But we were on our way back from this little island called Namina. And all of a sudden the boat stops and the captain says, we're surrounded by a pod of pilot whales. And so we jumped in and swam with them. And it was extraordinary to be surrounded by these giant whales. I thought I was at the end of the pod, but actually I was in the middle. And all of a sudden I'm surrounded by whales to the left, to the right, below me. And it was an extraordinary impact. After that, we went to Maui to be near the birthing of humpback whales. And I was going to do a recording of what I was going to be a lullaby to whales. But when I tuned into the consciousness of the cetaceans, and by that I mean whales and dolphins, the entire class of sea mammals that we call whales and dolphins, there was a despair. And I could not, in authenticity, compose a lullaby. And so musically, it became this contrast between a major and minor key, which is very odd. And I was really caught in a paradox of what do I do with this? And Judy and I had conversations about this, and she is, in our conversations, we're often able to come to understanding things that would not take place if we didn't dialogue. And through that dialogue, I came to understand that it was actually a lament for whales. And as soon as I had that understanding, I heard the voice of the shaman singing. And the shaman singing was up in Alaska. And he was singing to a friend of his who was a humpback whale that he had known for decades, and he was saying goodbye. that the oceans were changing, and that he was sorrowful that his grandchildren would not know, would never see the humpbacks because they would be gone. They would only know it through legend. He was singing the joy of having known another being and wishing him well on his journey into the other worlds. And so I composed that piece, and it's on the website in the listening section, Lament for Whales. Also listed are conservancy organizations that are actually doing something to help the oceans. And I think that's a pivotal point that we are at as a culture. The world is changing. There are forces that are far beyond our control. And we have choice making to do. And do we just walk away from the earth, or do we actually do something to affect what we can? Plant a tree, love the earth, contribute to an organization that might be helping the earth. So anyways, as we had this conversation about the movie, I wanted to reference the Lament for Whales because that is part of what's going on for me in the whole dynamic of Earth and the transformation we're experiencing as spiritual beings having a human experience. The Earth, the mother that we are a part of and that we are living on, is going through extreme duress, and animal and plant species are disappearing. And I don't think it is spiritually correct to pretend that that's not happening. I think what is called for is becoming more present, and then making whatever choice a person makes is their own choice. But all of this is within the context of honoring the earth. And we have to honor the earth if we're going to survive. Earth is going to be fine. People have asked me from time to time, will Earth be okay? And, oh, yeah, Earth is going to be fine. She may have to do some house cleaning, but she's going to be fine. We might be history. And as Carl Sagan said, extinction is the rule and survival is the exception. So when you look at all the various species, they all go eventually extinct. And humans, we have ourselves up on a pedestal that we're somehow above the ecosystem. Mm. And that arrogance is actually, in my experience, biting us right now.
When you and I were talking last week, we were talking about trees.
Yes.
Actually not producing oxygen in certain parts of this country anyways, did we not?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, there's this particular species of tree, I believe it's a pine, but I'd have to double check, that is just stopped producing oxygen. Normally in photosynthesis they absorb carbon dioxide and produce oxygen, and the trees in this particular area of the Southwest, is especially Colorado, is evidently not producing oxygen. And here in the west coast of the United States, the starfish in the Pacific Ocean have some type of disease that they literally are wasting away.
Mm-hmm.
And the orca whales that live here, the pods are challenged because the salmon reserves are disappearing, are decreasing, not disappearing, but decreasing. So there is ecological stress everywhere. And anyone can just go to any reputable conservancy organization and read reports about what's happening to the ecology. It's not the news. It doesn't come into the news, the mainstream news, because for various factors, who knows. But it's happening. It's happening all around us. So the movie is my hope for the movie at the very end, when Om Gaia takes place, there'll be that welling up that you experienced. And we've been told by many people who've seen the film that same thing happens for them. Something wells up, yes, and it's a waking up that we live in something precious, that the Gaia is a precious being, and there's a deep ancient resonance, and it's also a calling to living the future in a different way, both of those simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just a momentary feeling either. It's been reverberating in me. And I've asked others the same, or others have told me the same, long after we've left the film, weeks ago, months ago, when I first saw it.
That's a great
and
sign. That means it was successful.
Very successful, because as I said, you know, we talk about, you know, going to workshops and people or seminars or listening to something teleseminar and everybody gets a high, or people get a high for the time that they're there and for a couple of days afterwards, what was and is so astounding to me is it is the deep reverberation that still continues within me. It could bring me to tears right now, of the connection, the oneness, the lamenting, if you will, going on this earth. And I am just in deep reverence for your bringing that opportunity for us to feel it, not just to intellectualize and theorize about it.
Right, and I think you hit it on the head when you said lament. It is both the lament of our situation. It is the hope that something can change and the inspiration that allows us to generate the energy to change something. Mm-hmm. Even, you know, when you enter a new territory that you've never entered before, psychologically, emotionally, culturally, there's so many unknowns, but there has to be an energetic that drives a person to take an action that is hopeful in the midst of hopelessness, if that makes sense.
Sure does.
And so I think that's what paradoxically happens in the very last part of the film when the Hathors started chanting Om Gaia and this honoring of Earth. I think that's what people feel, because unless somebody is blind to what is happening, and as again, we all live in our own reality tunnels, and I'm sure that some people see this film and can't relate to it, but I think anyone who's would describe themselves as spiritually open sense when that occurs that we are living in a very surrealistic, potent time, and there is a lament for Earth and the loss of the species, and that song, the energetic at the very end of Gaia's song, introduces hope and an inspiration, spiritual inspiration. Mm-hmm. Something wells up that is ancient, primordial, rooted outside of our current time and space. And that's what drives the inspiration. And I think that's what people sense.
I really feel that as well. And I'll just say this now to our audience. Tom has been gracious enough to, at the end, we'll play about 6 minutes of Om Gaia, the song to Gaia. And I'll talk a little bit more about that nearing the end, but the experience is beyond words. And with that said, you and I also had no idea about this. You and I were talking last week, and you were sharing with me the stories behind many of the locations, the chants, and the spontaneous sound healings that, of course, none of us would know in watching this film. And for me, there were two in particular more fascinating, actually, to me than when you went into two of the particular caves in southern France, first to sing the Song of Sophia, the feminine principle of consciousness within the Western Christian tradition, and then when you went into a larger cave nearby where a very vast being came to meet you and give you a message about humanity's ability to continue forward, which you in turn translated into another very emotional chant. Will you share with our audience, Tom, some of these stories behind what we saw?
Yeah, sure. The cave, the big cave where this being was, none of this was scripted or planned out. It all happened spontaneously, and it was captured on film. And that's what's the beauty of it. When your listeners, if they watch the film, what they're seeing is the unfolding of spontaneity. So when we went into the big cave, we really didn't know what was in there, how big it was, or what was in there. So as soon as we start entering the cave, I sense this vast earth being. And the cave is huge, and what I loved about that scene, it is so Jungian, so archetypal. I'm walking over stones that where they're very slippery, and I'm descending literally into the darkness, the primordial darkness. And Sophie's got a light, a lantern, and she slips, and I say, "Whoa, be careful, it's slippery here." And that's exactly what happens as we enter the subterranean world. What the shamans call the underworld, and both underworld psychologically and in this case the underworld of the earth. And so I'm going deep down into the, I went down into the pit of this cave. It was the darkest place, the deepest place in it. I felt this being. And so Sophie has the lantern illuminating my face. I'm surrounded by darkness, of course. Ward is filming. And this being comes forward, and the immensity of it was startling to me. And my face actually morphs, and I look like a different person to me when I watch the film. And I say, this is not, doesn't look like the Tom I know when I look in the mirror. And it was the energy of this being coming through, which often happens for me when these beings, these energetics enter my field. And he sang this very primordial, guttural sound and toning session that lasted, I don't know, a minute or two. And when it was over, as we're walking out of the cave, I could translate what he had done in pure sound into language, and I basically said, I'm summarizing what he said, that it was something to the effect that he has been here for a long time, and he has seen many civilizations come and go, and he's very saddened by the state of humanity, and that humanity must find a way to honor the earth and the beings of the earth if it's to survive.
And when he and that was the Reader's Digest version, your translation was actually even more than that, was it not? The information that he gave you. Will you share that with us?
Well, I actually don't remember the exact words here, but that was the essence of it, that we have to, that humans are not paying attention and honoring the earth, and they're dishonoring the earth and dishonoring the beings of the earth, and that we need to wake up and honor the earth and the beings of the earth. They're living beings. They're dimensional energies of the earth. And if we don't wake up to that, then we won't survive. And it's very interesting. I met and was privileged to meet an Inuit shaman who was extraordinary power and awareness. And she said to me that in their prophecies, they say that there'll be a point where the non-natives, the white people, although they don't use the word that, but those who are not native will come to a point where they will have to return to the native understanding in order to survive. And then that native understanding is shamanically rooted in the earth, that we live in a world that is a complex tapestry of celestial heavenly energies, energies of the earth that we can see, and also energies inside the earth that are part of the earth that we can't see with our physical eyes, but we can sense them with our psychic vision and our feeling nature. And honoring those three realms is what will need to occur for us to make this passage collectively. That is what she said the Inuit understanding was.
And talk to us about that the first cave before you went into this much larger cave,
Sophia,
where you were inspired to sing the song of Sophia, and what that really means, Tom.
Well, in the original understanding of Sophia, this goes back before the first century AD, right around the time of Yeshua, there was an understanding that there was the logos, the male principle that created the world through the impulse of thought. But Sophia was the feminine aspect, and the feminine aspect received the thought in the womb of space and created that impulse of creation. So everything that existed was a result of the interaction between the logos and Sophia. And this is recapitulated in many spiritual traditions around the world, like in India, Tantra, the understanding, for instance, Brahma and Sarasvati. Brahma created the world by uttering the sound Om, but it's actually the tantric relationship between Sarasvati, the feminine, and the masculine Brahma that is responsible for creation. And then Vishnu and Lakshmi sustains it, and Shiva and Parvati destroy things that need to be destroyed. And it is all a tantric interaction between the male and female. And Tibetan Buddhism is called Kala Chakra, which is two opposites, the male-female principle, in an alchemical relationship create energies. So in this Christian tradition that we no longer have, because around the first century, Sophia was ushered out, the feminine mystery was ushered out of the Christian tradition, and the Holy Trinity became the Logos, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and there was no mentioning of the feminine principle. But Sophia is central to the mystical understanding and the foundations of Christianity, certainly as I've come to know it and understand it. So when we went into that first cave, I really didn't know, again, what would emerge. All of these were spontaneous. None of them were scripted. We walk into the cave. I know I'm going to do some type of toning, and it actually captures where Judy comes up and she's stroking my hair and she's just, you know, getting me ready for the camera. But what happened for me in that moment is that for me, Judy is the living Sophia. She's the living feminine in my life. And so because we are in southern France and the archetypes are Christian, I think that's why Sophia came through.
As you just shared that about Judy being the living Sophia, I have to ask you, for those that haven't seen the movie, will you share the story about you and Judy? And when you first met, how that was astounding. And it was done in that very comical way, but astounding. Will you share that with us?
Yeah, it is astronomically improbable that this would occur. So when we were working on the Magdalene manuscript that Judy and I worked together with Mary Magdalene, in her part of the story of her life, she wrote how, as a child, she was riding in her car and went by a bus and looked into the up and saw a little boy. And I had the same experience. I remember being on a bus, looking down and seeing a little girl, and we were about the same age. She was a little older than me, but not much. And so we were talking about that, and she said, well, yeah, but I know exactly where it happened. And I said, well, I know exactly where this happened too, and it was the exact same spot on the road. And we actually visited there and went to that spot, and that's where it occurred. So it's very interesting that I was around, I would guess, 9 years old, something like that. I look out a bus, I see this little girl in a car about my age, and our eyes locked, and there was a deep connection, but we didn't actually physically meet for decades. Very interesting and odd. We live
and then
in
how
a really
you
strange
met.
Universe. Do what?
And then how you met? Decades
later. Oh, you
later.
Mean
will you share
the Christmas
that?
Present? You mean yes. The Christmas present?
Yes.
Yes, right.
Yes.
Yeah, she called me and asked
I
me if
I
would.
I love that part, too.
Yeah, that was very humorous. She had a friend named Ola, who is a wonderful man, just extraordinary sterling character, beautiful person, powerful, creative person, and she wanted to give him a birthday gift that would be unusual. And she had heard about me and called, and she said it's not something she would normally do, and there was this message on my machine and said, would you, you don't know me, my name is Judy Zion, and I want to give a gift to my friend of a toning session. Would you be that gift, and what would you charge? And as I said in the movie, I did not do private work at that point. I had switched to group work. But the Hathors urged me. The Hathors never tell me what to do, but they really encouraged me to meet this person and do this request. And so Judy came over with Ola, and they toned, and that began a friendship that eventually blossomed into something much deeper.
And then you realized that you had locked eyes on this bridge from you in the bus, she in the car, at about 9 years old.
Uh-huh, yeah.
How profound a divine weaving is that?
Yeah, it's profound, but I tell you what, Judy and I both say, I think the timing was off. The timing is not necessarily what we prefer in this universe, is my experience. I mean, we both wish we had met earlier. But
well,
better late than never is
the evolution. The evolution for both of you, it was just perfect. So back to the movie, not the comical part of the movie, because actually it is depicted just for our audience. Tom is very funny, for those of you that may not know him. I always actually used to call you the Laughing Buddha, and I actually have a picture of you where you have the rind of a watermelon over your mouth as this big smile as you were sitting doing a workshop. Mm-hmm. And I think about that often, actually. It's very funny. But the way that it was, here is this, you come in and out of these amazing portals of sound healings and deepening and altered consciousness. And then there are these very funny depictions in comic-like ways, like a comic book ways, of mm-hmm. some very profound moments. Even if you'll share, too, when you were at the college, you were going into the dormitory, but you got very sick. Remember that?
Yes, that was a kundalini.
Do you want to share that with us, too?
Well,
that was
very
profound.
When I was 18, I was walking across my uncle's cow pasture and had a spontaneous samadhi experience, yogic samadhi, which is a deep inner trance. I didn't even know what samadhi was or what yoga was, but I sat down and went into a half lotus, and my hands went into mudras, and I went into what's called Sat Chitananda, and I lost all awareness of the world. I was pure bliss, peace, and awareness, only aware of itself, for quite a long time. And it was such a profound experience. I started searching for what is the nature of this? This is so unusual. And it led me into the Christian contemplative tradition and eventually into the Eastern religions and to shamanism, to try to find the commonality, the language that would describe what I had experienced. And at this, when I was at the University of North Carolina, I was pursuing my degree in communications and also a minor in psychology. And I was doing all these practices, meditation practices, unguided, I might say, and I was sometimes meditating 5 hours a day in addition to holding down jobs to put myself through school and going to school. So it was a spring day, and I had this, I was sitting in the quadrangle, and I had a kundalini release, which is when the primordial energy charge at the base of the spine moves up the spine. It opens the chakras and moves up into the head. It's depicted like a cobra in terms of symbolism, because what is occurring is that this energy moves up the spine and spreads out like the hood of a cobra and spreads out through the two hemispheres of the brain and activates neural connections in the brain that are normally not activated, and it alters perception profoundly. And the central point here is that our experience of the world is mitigated by what's happening in our brain neurologically. So my neurology was profoundly altered by this primordial energy, and all of a sudden I could see through the dorm walls. I could feel people's experiences, their hopes, their desires, their fears. It was close to exam time, so there was a lot of anxiety on campus. And there was a second kundalini release, and I started getting very hot. It's called psychic fire, and it's when the kundalini starts to purify the impurities in the subtle neurology of the body, called the meridians in the Chinese system and the nadis in the yogic system of India. Anyways, these are all burning up. I'm like hot, sweating. I start to walk back to the dorm, and I'm so tired and exhausted I can't really get to the dorm. The student health center's right there. I go to the student health center, actually crawl in the door because all the energy is leaving my arms and legs, and they take my temperature and they put me in a room. And for 3 days I'm delirious with a high fever. And what I'm experiencing is the archetypal subconscious contents of my own being, and it's pure Jungian psychology. And I was on a raft, and serpents are trying to pull me into the water, and the funniest part that I was, for me personally, was that I was, and it happened over and over again during the 3 day period, and I was driving my grandfather's car, and the sun was setting, and I could see the sun setting in the reflection of the steering wheel, the hub, and off in the distance is a little like a pueblo, and it keeps there. Inside, I know there's the secret of the universe. So everything I want to know about the universe and life is there, but it hops across the desert, and I never get to it. And after the 3 days were over, the delirium, the fever passed, and I was exhausted for about 6 weeks, because what had occurred was that I had pushed the river. I had opened the gates to the Kundalini Shakti and forced her to move. And now I don't do things like that. I allow her to move in her own wisdom. Mm. But that was the essence of that experience. Made me... Go ahead. It just made me more attentive to and more respectful of this primordial energy that every human being possesses. It's part of our nature.
Yeah. And yet, you depicted this in the film, and truly one of the funniest, I was hysterical laughing at that, ways something so, just the way this film has been blended on so many levels, it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating.
The contrasts work.
And seamless. Really seamless, yes. The contrasts really do work, and they don't even seem like contrasts, which was very interesting as well. It's fantastic. So I would be very remiss, of course, if I didn't talk with you about when you were in Tibet at a nunnery in Iyansi, where you are amongst nuns chanting in the most exquisite manner. Will you share with us why you went to that particular nunnery, Tom, and what your experience was like there?
Well, we were in Iyansi, which is a very remote part of Tibet, and our guide, Kim Ballard, took us there because he said these nuns really chant extraordinarily, and I really didn't know that nuns chanted as well as they did. These nuns were, from a musical standpoint, as good or, and I'm probably committing blasphemy here by saying that in this instance, they were better than the Gyoto monks that people are very familiar with. These are exquisite musicians, and the chants just transported you into the other worlds. It was a truly amazing. And so after it's over, this was like our second or third trip to Tibet. And Tibet is a very demanding place physically. It's a very demanding place emotionally. And so as we leave, we're going back to the bus. And I say to Judy, thank God my karma with Tibet is over. I don't have to come back. And she said, well, I'll miss you. And I turn and look at her. And I say, what do you mean? So I'm coming back to record the nuns. These voices need to be kept. And I said, well, of course, I'm going to join you. So it was her idea to... And it's really part of the work we do as a couple, and I'm really glad that it's expressed in the film. It's about the male-female relationship, and what the Iyansi nunnery began was we recorded them. We went back on a separate trip and recorded them, and that recording was the first and maybe the only, certainly that I'm aware of, the recording of the Iyansi nunnery of women chanting in Tibet. And through the Sound Healing Foundation that we set up, all the money goes back to the nuns. And we did the same thing in Bhutan, and all the money goes back to the nuns and the chanters of the Chod in Bhutan. So it's a reversal of what the Western tradition is, which is you go in and record something, and then you take it and you get back a smidgen. But in this case, everything, all the profits go back to the nuns in Tibet, in this case, Iyansi. And also in Bhutan now. And it was an extraordinary experience on many levels. And one of the funny stories is, of course, the nuns had, the abbot is a very wise person. She was, and I noticed when we were traveling with her that she was truly the expression of loving kindness, that she would not eat until she was sure that everybody has something to eat. She's the high abbot of this nunnery, but she would serve tea. It was an amazing level that she operated at. She was the expression of the bodhisattva energetic. And so we were in Bhutan before we went back to this to the nunnery to give back into Tibet to give some money to the nunneries directly. Now we can wire money, and back then we had to take it in. And so we're at a monastery in Bhutan, and I see this, it's tingshas, which are like little metal symbols, and on some string, and I have this strong pull to get it, and I just trust these impulses. So I bought it in Bhutan at a monastery during the high celebration of Padmasambhava, Guru Rinpoche, who brought Buddhism into Tibet and also Bhutan, Nepal. And I take and I buy some leather and z-beads. Z-beads naturally occur in Tibet, and strung it together. And we go to see the abbot, and we're about ready to give them some money. And the money they used to fix a hole in the wall, clothe all the nuns because they were all threadbare, enlarge the nunnery, also give them, allow them to purchase sacred art, and establish two nuns to become what are called monk nun doctors. In other words, they're trained in both the traditional Chinese medicine and the medicine of Buddhism, and they will, when they finish this program, they will be giving medical services to the whole community of Gyantse. So all of this was, we were about to impart this to the abbot. But I said, before we give this to you, I was in Bhutan, and you have to understand that the tingshas probably cost, in our terms of money, $10. And then the z-beads and everything added to it. But the actual cost of the tingshas was probably $10 U.S., and so I said, but first, before we give you the money and talk about what the money that's been raised by people through this project, I want to gift you with a set of tingshas. And she, I'll never forget the moment. Her eyes welled up with tears. Mm. She held her heart, and she took the tingshas, and she said, "We needed tingshas, but we couldn't afford them."
Mm.
And it's just extraordinary to see how people, the gifts of people who purchased the CDs and the money that it created, and how it has changed the nunnery for the better. And
absolutely,
all of this came out essentially of Judy saying to me on the bus, "Well, I'll miss you."
Mm.
So
amazing. Three words.
Mm-hmm. Right. Excuse me. So.
That's absolutely fantastic. It's a fantastic. It's a fantastic story. It's a fantastic blessing and gift that you both gave to each other, and then we as those that are watching this magnificent song of the new earth get to experience the exquisiteness of this beautiful, beautiful group of nuns in the Yangtze. I want to ask you something, and this was another standout moment for me in the film, Tom, at the end when you were walking away, suitcase mm-hmm. in hand, and with your back turned, you said, and it seemed almost to yourself, "The war inside is finally over."
Yes.
And I don't think it's difficult to understand what those words mean, but
mm-hmm.
what does it feel like, Tom, really, to reach a point, because I've contemplated this a lot, within oneself, where one can actually say the war inside is truly over? And what happened during the filming of Song of the New Earth that prompted you to have that realization?
Well, I think what it goes back to is an experience that I had when I was at the University of North Carolina. And I lived at one point, I lived in a lot of different housing every year, you know. And I was living at this particular point in a very large, old, dilapidated house that probably should have been condemned, but the rent was cheap. And I was living in what had been either the ballroom or a really, really big dining room. And in one corner, I had a mattress on the floor because I was, you know, a starving student. Everything I had, I was putting to get through school. And so I had a mattress on the floor and books and, you know, all this stuff, half-written papers and laundry and all that. On the far side of the room, there was an altar with a prayer rug and pictures of the saints of all the traditions that I was exploring, and that was every major tradition of the world, and flowers and a candle, and everything was pristine. It was like it was like a different person lived in that corner of the room. And I remember a friend of mine who'd never seen my living situation, he and I were going to a concert, and he knocked on the door, and I opened the door, and he steps in, and he looks around, he looks over to the right where the mess is, where I'm living, and he looks over to the left where there's this prayer rug and the little altar, and he says, "Who's your roommate?" A little dim light bulb went off in my head. It's like, whoa, yeah, there is conflict between the spiritual part of me and the human part of me. And for me, growing in the tradition, spiritual religious tradition that I grew in, and the different traditions I explored, that was an essential tension between the human being and the spiritual being. And how do you bridge the two? That was one of the paradoxes that, and I could tell you stories. We'd be here all night talking about stories where it was driven home to me. You don't quite have Tom, don't have the understanding that there is a place where the human being, as living flesh and blood, seamlessly, beautifully, exquisitely nest within a spiritual being that is transcendent to time and space. There is no innate tension between these two, except what was introduced to us by religion. Mm. So, at the point, and when I say that in the film, we were culminating, that was just one of those random interviews that we were doing, and it just fit in at the very end because it pulled pieces together. And so what it feels like is that there is no innate tension in myself, no shame about being a human being. It's an amusing paradox. It is sometimes difficult, but the shame is gone, and the shame came from the religious training I had received and some of the spiritual traditions I embraced. But when I separated these out and got down to the truth for me, I'm just speaking for myself, the truth is that I am a spiritual being having human experience, and that the being a human being is part of the exquisite mystery and not something to be denigrated or set aside as being flawed or wrong. There's something important and beautiful about being a human being, and also at the same time a spiritual being that transcends all phenomena, all time and space. Those two together coexisting brought the war to an end for me.
And thank you for, as it has been brought to an end for you, it can't help but reach out to everyone else and help that war inside of the many start to come to a conclusion. Thank you very much for sharing that story. I really, really appreciate that. I'm sure we all appreciate that. So in closing tonight, we have the gift of hearing about 6 minutes of Song to Gaia, which the Song to Gaia is in its entirety on the CD Atheos. And that's on your website.
Aethos, A-E-T-H-O-S.
Yeah, Atheos, yeah. A-T-H-E-O-S, yes?
Right.
Okay, in its entirety at tomkenyon.com. And Tom, I'd just like to thank you so much for being my guest tonight, our guest tonight, for being my mentor, for being the man that you are, and for all that you have done on behalf of humanity and this beloved planet of Earth. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And as always, I just want to say to the audience, thank you all for being exactly who you are. I can't say enough about, if you have the opportunity, don't miss the Song of the New Earth. It is an extraordinary documentary. And it will really, it will transport you beyond any words that I can say, or even I think that Tom could say. Remember that you're loved. Enjoy this next few minutes of Song to Gaia. And until next time, I wish you all so much love. Namaste.
Oh,